and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper dated Wednesday, August the 17th. And I'm your reader, Kevin Boucher. And the headline for the first article today, Council takes no action on parking rates. And this story was written by reporter Dolly Butts. The Sioux City Council didn't take any action on Monday on a staff proposal to increase rates for municipal parking ramps, meters, and fines. The current rate for metered parking is 60 cents per 30 minutes and 75 cents per hour. Now, if the council votes in favor of these adjustments, those fees would increase to 80 cents per 30 minutes and $1 an hour. In our discussions initially, we had a higher rate increase on the monthly parkers. And through a lot of discussions with our downtown partners, it was kind of discussed that they would rather put more of the onus on the violators than the parkers. And that's a quote from Sioux City Public Works Director Dave Carney. He addressed the city council on Monday. And under the current proposal, parking meter overtime fines would rise from $10 to $14 after 30 days, from $15 to $21, and after 90 days, from $30 to $42. Other parking-related fines in the proposal would increase from $35 to $50, after 30 days, from $40 to $50, and after 90 days, from $50 to $70. The last rate increase in Sioux City for street meter fees occurred in 2007, while ramp fees and parking fines were raised in 2019. I don't see how you can justify a 40% increase on parking meter fines, but a 10% on a monthly parker, and that's a quote from Mayor Bob Scott. He continued, "Again, we favor the downtown dramatically. A person who is parking downtown there probably lives somewhere else in town. That came down 25 minutes late or 20 minutes late for whatever reason, a doctor's appointment." Mayor Scott requested a breakdown of parking fines by category so the council can see how many violators paid after 30 days and after 90 days. He also said he wants to see what the projected revenue would amount to if fines were increased. Carney told the council that back in January, the city's finance department came to him and showed him that after the current fiscal year, the parking fund balance would be negative. Ideally, the parking fund should be a self-sustaining fund to fund all the ramp improvements, ramp repairs, and also the maintenance of our meters and also our staff, said Carney, who noted that the city can no longer get the parts needed for its current parking meters. Carney said the city is replacing those meters with basic coin meters, not meters that accept credit cards. Councilwoman Julie Schoner wondered if the city could get rid of the meters altogether to save money and instead replace the physical meters with signs instructing parkers to pay by mobile app, which is something that other cities have done, she said. Many older residents won't understand how to use a parking app, or they might not even have a smartphone, according to Scott. Maybe one side of the street is signs and the other side of the street is meters. Split it up a little bit, Schoner said. McCarney said that he didn't think Schoner's suggestion would save the city enough money to forego a rate increase. And the headline for this next article, Sioux City man to stand trial for fatally shooting roommate. And this story was written by reporter Nick Hytrek. Jury selection is scheduled to begin in the trial of a Sioux City man accused of fatally shooting his roommate. Robert Buell, 53, has pleaded not guilty in Woodbury County District Court to second-degree murder and going armed with intent for the August 22nd shooting death of Jason Lafferty, 41, at their home, located at 211 21st Street in Sioux City. Jury selection is expected to last one day. Woodbury County Attorney Patrick Jennings would begin the presentation of witnesses' testimony and evidence later this week. According to a police report, Buell and Lafferty got into an argument inside the residence, and Lafferty went to the garage. And according to court documents, Buell stayed in his upstairs bedroom before getting a 12-gauge shotgun at a .45 caliber handgun and going to the garage. Buell told police he pointed the shotgun at Lafferty and then set it down. Lafferty took the gun and emptied the shells from it and then began reloading it. Buell then pulled the handgun from his coat pocket and fired three shots at Lafferty, striking him twice, according to court documents. When police arrived, Lafferty was dead, according to the police report. Detectives on the scene found the shotgun, which was empty, and all of the shells on the floor. The handgun and the three spent shell casings were also found. Buell's attorney, public defender Billy Oader, has filed notice that he will argue that Buell was justified in shooting Lafferty because he was protecting himself. If found guilty of second-degree murder, Buell could face a 50-year prison sentence. Going armed with intent carries a 5-year prison sentence. Headline: Sioux City man pleads not guilty in shots fired case. And this story was also written by Sioux City Journal reporter Nick Hytrak. A Sioux City man pleaded not guilty Monday of firing shots at a 17-year-old girl during an altercation. Aiden Wabashaw, 19, entered his plea in Woodbury County District Court to charges of intimidation with a dangerous weapon, going armed with intent, aggravated assault, and felon in possession of a firearm. According to court documents, the teen was at a friend's house in the 100 block of 15th Street on June 12th, and they began arguing. Wabashaw intervened and threatened her with a gun, just holding it inches from her head. The girl left but returned later to reconcile with her friend. Wabashaw then verbally threatened the girl. The girl left and then went to the Dale Street Park, where she encountered some male friends who escorted her back to her friend's home and got into a fight with Wabashaw, who drove away. The girl and her male friends went back to the park, but she returned to her friend's home with one of them later to retrieve belongings. Wabashaw exited the home and pointed a gun at them, according to court documents. And the girl told police that as she and her male friend ran away, they heard two gunshots. Hours later, a Sioux City police officer stopped Wabashaw for failing to stop at a stop sign. And after Wabashaw consented to a search of his vehicle, police found a 9mm handgun inside a bag, and Wabashaw admitted the handgun was his. Headline: NOAM releases social study standards burnishing U.S. history. And this article was written by reporter Stephen Groves of the Associated Press. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem recently released a revised proposal for social studies standards in public schools that lays out a mostly shining vision of American history. And after an initial draft of the standards came under heavy criticism last year from conservatives and Native American educators, the Republican governor claimed the new proposed standards are free from what she calls political agendas and include an increased focus on Native American history. But they received swift criticism from some educators as a thinly veiled political document. They emphasize the qualities of America's founders and mimic language that Noem has used as she jumped on the conservative cause of weeding certain divisive teachings on race from public schools. The 15-member standards work group, selected partially by the governor, include NOM's chief of staff, two Republican lawmakers, and the director of the South Dakota Catholic Conference. But just three educators are certified by the Department of Education. The work of the group was facilitated by William Morrissey, a former professor at Hillsdale College. Hillsdale College is a conservative institution in Michigan that has tried to remake education across the country. Governor Kristi Noem, who is seen as a possible 2024 White House contender, has also advocated for the 1776 pledge to save our schools as a part of a conservative drive to emphasize the quality of the founders of the United States. The social studies standards, which provide a list of topics that students should comprehend at each K through 12 grade level, are widely followed by school districts, but are not mandatory. The new 128-page document more than doubles the length of the proposed standards the Department of Education released last year. They would make the sprawling argument that the United States, though not without fault, is an exceptional nation that has uniquely advanced rights for every race and gender. They are also peppered with Christian history and explore the region's influence on the nation's leading figures and Western civilization. For example, 7th grade students are expected to explain how the nation's founders advanced equal rights for every person and advance the idea that each person is endowed with these rights by the God that created them, and that the existence of human slavery was understood by most, but not all, of the founders to be a contradiction on the principle of human equality. The standards state that they are intended in part to foster a love of country that, like any love, is not blind to faults. Nick Tilson, he's the president of an indigenous advocacy organization called NDN Collective, said that when the standards start out with goals like that, they are bound to further a narrative that continues to treat minority groups unjustly. Her approach in this curriculum further perpetuates ignorance, further perpetuates racism and white supremacy, he said, adding, "These priority areas are dominated by nationalism. These proposed standards are the Noem administration's second attempt to update the learning objectives." Headline, UNL student is a part of a winning team at an international soil judging contest. And this story was written by Chris Dunker of the Lincoln Journal Star newspaper. The sandy reddish-brown soils of Scotland weren't the dark, clay-heavy soils of Nebraska, Iowa, and the Great Plains that Kennedy Griffiths and her colleagues on Team USA were used to, but the outcome for the best collegiate soil judges in the United States was on the world stage just the same. Griffiths is a soon-to-be junior environmental science major at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and her three teammates won top honors at the International Soil Judging Competition in Scotland, which was held July 26 through the 31st. And it's the fourth time Team USA has won the international competition hosted by the World Congress of Soil Science, but it's the first time a Cornhusker has competed. "It was kind of expected, but still exciting," said Griffiths, a native of Lincoln. "Being able to come home and say that I was a part of the team that got first in the world is pretty special." But the competition wasn't easy for Griffiths and teammates Ben Atkins and Claire Talame of Virginia Tech and Isaac Nolan of the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. When Team USA arrived in Scotland the week of the competition, they had to quickly determine who would be tackling what task during the hour-long team contest in Scotland. It ended up working very well, Griffiths said, and when we got to the competition, everyone got serious all of a sudden and realized that we have to work together. Griffiths was assigned to judge the texture and color of the soils during the competition. The spodosoils and histosoils, reddish-brown and sandy and full of organic matter, were vastly different than the soils of the Great Plains because of the more frequent precipitation, which Griffiths said was something she had little experience with before arriving in Scotland. Her teammates from Virginia Tech, where the soils are sandier and more organic, helped Griffiths calibrate her judging by breaking down a sample in her hand to look for decomposed material. I really had to lean on my teammates and was asking them for a lot of help throughout the week, she said. One of the pits for the individual competition was entirely organic, something that Griffiths had never attempted to judge before, she said. The day I had to, there was no other choice, she said. I used everything I learned that week. The Americans beat out Mexico, Australia, Spain, South Korea, and Italy in the overall soil judging competition. And in summation, Griffiths says she plans to continue competing and build upon her experience at the international competition. She says, quote, there is so much more to see and so many more places to travel, she said, and it gave me an itch to keep exploring. And the headline for this next article, judge dismisses police, EMTs, and jailers from lawsuit over a woman's death at the Sarpy County Jail. This story was written by reporter Lori Pilger of the Lincoln Journal Star. The family of a woman who died of alcohol toxicity at the Sarpy County Jail in 2018 has lost its wrongful death lawsuit against the police, rescue workers, and jailers after she was taken to jail instead of a hospital. Danielle Harbison's blood alcohol content was 0.34%, more than four times the legal limit to drive. Attorneys for her estate and her children had argued the case should go forward because officials had been deliberately indifferent to her serious medical needs. But Chief U.S. District Judge Robert F. Rossiter Jr. ruled that all except one defendant, the city of Bellevue, were shielded from civil liability under qualified immunity and dismissed the claims against them. But because municipalities are not protected in the same way, the city of Bellevue remains the only party left being sued. It all started on the evening of June 23, 2018. Bellevue police officer Aaron Jezik was sent to Nebraska Medical Center about a woman who appeared to be passed out in a lane of traffic in a still-running truck, her foot on the brake. When Jezik woke, the driver, Harbison, who was lethargic, had very slurred speech. A second officer who arrived, Matt McGinn, described her as out of it and mumbling. Jezik detained her and called Bellevue EMS to determine if she needed medical help. EMTs Jason Weber and Aaron McCormick talked with Harbison, who said she just wanted to go home. And so they left, telling the officer she had refused to go to a hospital and was denying any medical care. And though universal patient care guidelines used by their department say if a patient is deemed incompetent, the patient must be transported to a hospital, the standard operating procedures say that an incompetent individual includes someone who is intoxicated. While their medical evaluation certainly could have been more thorough, they simply did not observe many of the telltale signs showing Harbison's medical need, Rossiter said in his order last week. At most, their quick evaluation and failure to follow Bellevue fire procedures was grossly negligent, but that is not enough. After the EMTs left, Jezik and McGinn did a sobriety check where Harbison smelled of alcohol and had difficulty walking a straight line and couldn't perform other tests at all. And when they arrived, or when they arrested her for DUI, her blood alcohol consumption level tested at 0.34%, which McGinn said was higher than he had ever seen. So they took her to the jail, where staff at the jail came to believe she had been medically cleared. She was put on a 15-minute watch, but was never screened by the nurse. She was checked 28 times that night and into the next morning. With staff finding her asleep on the toilet, with vomit on her bed and on the floor at different times. In jail video, staffers said that they weren't cleaning it up and joked about whether to take her to a hospital. When Harbison was found on the floor snoring, Sergeant Mark Schiller instructed staffers to leave her there. At 2:01 in the morning, they found the 37-year-old unresponsive and performed CPR, but she died there. And so the judge said that viewing the circumstances together, he didn't believe a reasonable jury could find Schiller and the other correctional officers acted with deliberate indifference. Headline: Siouxland man sought on probation violation. The United States Marshal Service Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force is seeking the following person: Kerry Phillips, 28. He is 6 feet tall, 130 pounds, and is wanted by the U.S. Marshals Service on a warrant for violating probation. Phillips is on probation for a conviction of failing to register as a sex offender. Anyone with information is urged to call 712-252-0211. That telephone number once again is 712-252-0211. Headline: Cone Park tubing season extended into October. Although the pool season is coming to an end, there is still time to try summer tubing at Cone Park, 3400 Line Drive. Session days and times will occur from 6 to 8:30 p.m. on Fridays, and then again 12:30 to 3 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Saturdays. And on Sundays, tubing will go from 3 to 6 from now until October the 9th. Tickets for Cone Park's tubing series are sold on a first-come, first-served basis, and advance tickets may be purchased by calling 712-279-6126. And the headline for this next article: Democratic 4th District candidate skewers Republican policies. This was written by Caleb McCullough of the Journal's Des Moines Bureau. Ryan Melton said conservative policies have been hurting Iowa's 4th Congressional District, pitching his case to voters in his campaign against Republican Randy Feenstra at the Iowa State Fair. Melton, a Democrat, said he was the one pro-democracy candidate in the region. Skewering Feenstra for accepting the endorsement of Donald Trump in what he thought was a lukewarm response to the January 6 insurrection at the United States Capitol. In my opinion, the acceptance of Donald Trump's endorsement is a rejection of American democracy, he said at the Des Moines Register soapbox on Monday. Candidate Melton said he was inspired to run when he saw that no other Democrats were planning to challenge Feenstra in the highly conservative district. Feenstra took office in 2021 after defeating Republican Steve King in the 2020 primary. King had drawn criticism from Republicans for making inflammatory anti-immigration and white supremacist statements throughout his 18 years as a United States congressman. Melton named several areas of life that he thought were worse off under Republican state leadership, including child care, health care, and labor rights. Concerning a high rate of teachers leaving the profession, Melton said teachers in Iowa deserve higher pay, and her pattern of villainizing teachers has led some to leave the job. He said schools and teachers in Iowa need more money and more resources to help students who are struggling. We have so many kids going to school hungry. They're going to school dealing with problems at home, and they're certainly not going to school often in an ideal learning mindset, according to Melton. So we need teachers that are robustly paid and respected and not overworked to observe these kind of gaps in their students. And Feenstra's policy positions align with King's and are bad for the people of the 4th District, Melton contended. Congressman Feenstra's voting record is Steve King's voting record, he said. They are the exact same voting record. On the subject of carbon capture to slow down global warming, Melton called carbon sequestration a failed technology, and he criticized Feenstra for his support of the projects, which Melton says don't do enough for climate change and are prone to failure. Melton said, quote, "Why would you risk or why would you give the burden of risk of a carbon capture pipeline leak? Why would you put that burden on us on the ground just so corporations can rake in massive profits from that?" The Register said that it had invited all the candidates for state and federal office to speak at the soapbox. Feenstra never showed up, but through a spokesperson, they said, quote, "Randy Feenstra is a true Christian conservative who has led on protecting life, liberty, and freedom." And that's a quote from Republican Party of Iowa spokesperson Colin Compton. Colin continued, "Feenstra was one of the first voices to warn about inflation and has fought tooth and nail for Northwest Iowa's farms, families, and small businesses." You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper dated Wednesday, August the 17th, here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now let's turn to today's obituaries. James Jim Jasper, 84, of Sioux City, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, June 29th, 2022, at a Sioux City hospital surrounded by family. Jim was born in Orange City, Iowa, on June 23, 1938, to Henrietta and James Jasper. Jim went on to serve in the U.S. Navy from 1955 to 1961, and while on shore leave in Los Angeles, he met his beautiful, soon-to-be bride, Judy. Together, Jim and Judy built a life in Iowa and had four children, Dan Jasper, Jenny Huckins, Donna and Lauren Robinson, and Kim and John Coffer. Jim and his wife also had 12 grandchildren and 12 great-grandchildren. Jim is now at peace with his beautiful wife of 64 years. Linda Lee Jennings of Sioux City, Iowa, 74, died on Tuesday, August 9, 2022. A celebration of life is pending, and arrangements for Linda Lee Jennings are with Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Gary D. Kampf, 75, of South Sioux City, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, August 10, 2022, surrounded by his loved ones. Gary was born on August 5, 1947, to Edward and Elise Kampf. He grew up in South Sioux City before joining the United States Air Force in May of 1966. He joined the Air Force on May 12, 1966, completing his basic training at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. Gary was stationed in the Philippines at Clark Air Force Base during the Vietnam War. His military medals include GCM, NDSM, Small Arms Marksmanship Ribbon, and Presidential Unit Citation with Oak Leaf Cluster, Outstanding Unit Award, and Vietnam Service Medal, Gary received an honorable discharge. He belonged to the American Legion of South Sioux City, enjoying his membership there for 34 years. Gary married his high school sweetheart, Colleen Hansen, on February 3, 1968, in Colorado Springs, Colorado. They enjoyed 50 years together, both loving country music and being members of the Strollers Car Club. He was an auto body repairman before joining the railroad. He worked over 35 years before retiring in December of 2008. Gary is survived by his sisters of South Sioux City, Cheryl Hutchins, Junie Engel, and Barbara J. Bauman, and Beverly Kenny Smith of Gibbon, Nebraska. Gary was preceded in death by his first wife, Colleen, his second wife, Jean, his parents, three brothers, Terry Kempf, Larry Kempf, and Carrie Kempf, sister Margot Smith, and nephew Danny Hutchins. Stanley N. Navrud Sr. of Dakota Dunes. The family of Stanley Norris Navrud Sr. is sad to announce his passing on Friday, August 12, 2022, at the age of 83. He died peacefully in his home at Dakota Dunes after a brief illness. A private celebration of life will be held at a later date. Meyer Brothers Chapel Colonial Chapel is assisting with arrangements. He was born in Soldier, Iowa in 1938. He attended the University of Nebraska and went on to complete his Master's of Business Administration at the University of South Dakota. He had a long and successful career in finance as a stockbroker and a certified financial planner. He was a civic leader in the Siouxland and Woodbury County area. He served as chairman and board of directors for the Lutheran Services for the state of Iowa. He was also board member of Lutheran Social Services. He was an active member of First Lutheran Church of Sioux City, serving as vice president and other officer positions over the years. He was a proud father of his two children, Stan Jr. and Joy, and his grandchildren, Connor, age 30, Spencer, age 26, and Noel, age 14. Stanley enjoyed his time traveling around the world, Norway being his favorite, but he was always happy to come home to the other place he called home, Sioux City, Iowa. Mary Lou Feaster of Newcastle, Nebraska, 91, received her heavenly rewards on Tuesday, August 9, 2022. She passed away peacefully at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital with family by her side. Mary Lou was a devout Catholic and a lover of life, mother of two, grandmother of two, step-grandmother of three, and great-grandmother of five. She was born on February 17, 1931 in Newcastle, where she spent most of her life. She was the only daughter of Lucy Hoy and Frank Kroger. Mary Lou earned a teaching degree from Wayne State College and spent the first years of her career teaching all grades and classes in a country school. After moving on from teaching, she worked as a banker for more than 30 years. She worked in Sioux City, St. Paul, Minnesota, and at the American State Bank in Newcastle, which is now the Bank of Dixon County. Mary Lou married the love of her life, Louis Feaster, on November 10, 1956. They were married until his death in 1980. Later in life, after Louis' death, she enjoyed the companionship of Lawrence Becker and his family. She was a lifelong learner, had a deep curiosity for travel, history, and places. She enjoyed many excursions with Lawrence during their time together. She is survived by her children, Scott and Joanne Feaster of Portland, Oregon, and Susie Day of Newcastle, brother Don and Rainey Kroger of Omaha, grandchildren Connor and Casey Day of Newcastle, step-grandchildren Rhonda Plue, Eric Rollerkite, and Megan Benson, great-grandchildren Bain, Bell, Oakley, Harris, and Jackson, brother-in-law Lorne Feaster, and sisters-in-law Frances Pullman and Anna Marie Feaster. She was preceded in death by her husband Louis, parents, and son-in-law, Jean Day. She was loved by all who knew her and will be missed by all who were fortunate to spend time with her. And now, turning to the obituary page of the Sioux City Journal newspaper, this first article is headlined, Cheers and Jeers. State Transportation Commission visits the region. Pools are closing too early. And this was written by the editorial board of the Sioux City Journal. Well, starting off with a thumbs up. The Iowa Department of Transportation Commission deserves credit for routinely moving its regular business meetings from its Ames headquarters to other parts of the state, as it did last week in Sioux City. In addition to holding its monthly business meeting at the convention center on Tuesday morning, the commission members toured the region the day before, getting a first-hand look at a number of completed projects and others in the works, including the new district DOT offices located on the outskirts of Sioux City. They also heard from local leaders who pitched future projects, key priorities like the replacement of the aging Gordon Drive Viaduct. Commissioner Cherise Yaney of Sioux City also hosted her colleagues and DOT staff with some fun-filled activities on Monday as they stopped by the Wells Blue Bunny Ice Cream Parlor in Lamar's and the Sioux City Railroad Museum. Thumbs down. Each year we've complained about city swimming pools closing too early. We're tossing another life preserver to the concept again this year. If one pool, say the Riverside Aquatic Center, remained open until Labor Day, it would be a great way to keep kids busy during some of the hottest days of the year. And the headline from the opinion page for this next article, Summer Lovin', Outdoor Concert, A Chance to Dance. And this was written by Anne Vandemortel. Turning in small circles with my hands clasped behind the neck of the neighbor boy I called my forced boyfriend, I entered the world of public dancing on the wooden floor of our junior high school gymnasium. 5 years later, a tunnel of light with colors swirling on the floor and arcing over my head ushered me into a throng of people sparkling with dots of light shining from a disco ball hanging from the ceiling as I entered the Omni Discotheque to celebrate my 18th birthday. The Bee Gees and Donna Summer blared through the speakers while dancers gyrated over colored lights flashing up from the dance floor. As many of the outdoor summer concert schedules are finishing up, crowds are packing the venues to enjoy another evening of free music and free dancing. The Quad Cities area of Iowa is fortunate to have choices of live, free outdoor music practically every night of the week. Young and old alike come with a chair slung over their shoulder and seek a favorite spot to sit. Each location has its own charm. A band shell nestled under majestic oak trees makes me envision the days when music from the stage was that of a barbershop quartet, wearing Panama straw skimmer hats while the ladies carried parasols and had their picnic baskets auctioned off to the highest bidder. There's the town square centered around a statue, providing a small dance floor which gets so crowded that dancers who need more room will spin around on the sidewalks. And the landing with a fountain and white canopy-covered stage that has lights strung above the area, creating an illusion of a starlit night, even before darkness descends. Dedicated performers and summer music followers brave sweltering nights when temperatures stay above 100 even after dinner, Somebody once said, dance like nobody's watching. Live like you'll never be hurt. Sing like no one is listening. Live like it's heaven on earth. And I think that must be the motto of the people who enjoy outdoor summer concerts. Throughout the years, we've had places to dance, ballrooms like the Coliseum in Fairyland for the big band era, and the prime years of rock and roll followed by Uncle Sam's and the Back Door. I don't know where people go to dance for the rest of the year, but in the summer we are dancing in the parks. We might be wearing knee braces and swallowing pain relief tablets, but whatever our circumstances, we don't care who's watching. We only hope the watchers are having as much fun as the dancers. I am moved by the impact of the music as it has on its people, and folks who stand supported by a walker sway and sing to tunes from their youth, and it's evident that some couples danced to these same songs many years ago. While watching them, I can see the years peel away in front of my eyes, and the women's sundresses and flip-flops turn into a poodle skirt and saddle shoes. These concerts here in the Quad Cities area will continue a while longer, even though the song of the cicadas threatened the end of summer. I'll ignore the cicadas and continue to enjoy watching the dancers. And I'll pretend I have a hairbrush while I crash around the dance floor under a starry sky. That was written by Anne Van de Mortel. She's a regular columnist. She's a Moline school nurse. She's a blogger, a grandmother of five, and a collector of people and their stories. And the headline for this next opinion piece from the Sioux City Journal newspaper, this is Dan Wooten's column. Don Wooten says Davenport's deal with rail company was a simple bribe. Last Wednesday, the Davenport, Iowa City Council voted unanimously to accept a bribe in exchange for the City Council agreeing not to object to a proposed rail merger. The city will get $8 million to use as it sees fit and an extra $2 million for grade separation at South Concord to permit passage of vehicle and pedestrian traffic when a train is passing by. The $2,000 is conditioned on the city raising the balance of the money required for the project from other sources. The proposed merger will join the Canadian Pacific Railway Company and its associated lines with Kansas City Southern Railway and its operating subsidiaries. The combined company will give CP's string of lines across southern Canada and northern U.S. a direct link to the Gulf Coast and Mexico. The key is that one link between Kansas City and Shreveport, Louisiana. And when you look at a map of the whole system, you realize that all the traffic in that single link is going to be funneled through Davenport, some 22 trains a day. That's up from the current daily average of 8. It's going to mean a lot of noise and interrupted access to Davenport's riverfront amenities, and it's not the sort of arrangement that citizens would approve in an election. But the citizens were not given a choice. The merger was first approved early in 2021, but was derailed when Canadian National put in a competing bid that offered Kansas Southern more money. The U.S. Surface Transportation Board killed that deal, and CP and KCS finally filed their application in October. Cities along the route were romanced with promises of many new jobs, heavy investment in improving aging railways, even potential passenger service. There was talk of noise mitigation, but it was mostly confined to the rumble of passing rail cars. I don't hear much about the muting of horns at crossings. And so those of us who live in Rock Island will share this noise. If the American Recovery Plan Act funneled federal money into states and cities to help citizens whose lives and incomes were impacted by the pandemic, local and regional political bodies were given wide latitude in distributing those funds. Scott County was not the only one to abuse the system. If the rail merger goes through and the city council uses the money that it receives wisely and justly, things can still go wrong, even with careful planning. What if someone suffers a heart attack when strolling in LeClaire Park while a train is passing by? How long might it take for an emergency vehicle to get through? Another issue, what if there is a spill? They do occur, and the nasty ones involve that thick Canadian oil, which is actually more like asphalt passing to the Gulf. One such spill occurred years ago in Arkansas, as I remember, and it devastated portions of a small town. But the news was kept under wraps for weeks until photographs taken by homeowners finally got out. It's hard to imagine the merger will not be approved, and all across corporate America, there is money to be made in mergers and acquisitions. Lawyers, investors, and executives earn serious money in the process. We seem to be drifting back to the area of huge trusts that dominate major sectors of the economy. Competitive capitalism may be the gospel, but it isn't quite the practice. And in summation, you hear complaints about overregulation, but the important ones that keep the financial sector in line have been steadily weakened over the past four decades. When big money moves, constraints weaken, and citizens take what they can get. And for Davenport, Iowa, it was a cool $10,000. And that was written by Dan Wooten. He is a former Illinois state senator and a regular columnist. And this last article from the opinion page, it's a letter. Headline, Franken will be a strong voice for Iowa families. Admiral Michael Franken grew up in a farming community in Sioux City, Iowa, on the western border of the state. He understands the challenges facing rural communities. Admiral Franken grew up and spent his career in public service, primarily serving in the Navy, which includes a prominent assignment in Washington, D.C. He has the experience and knowledge to get the things done in the U.S. Senate. Franken will be a strong voice for Iowa families. He supports policies that'll create good-paying jobs, improve access to affordable health care for all, and he'll make sure to make college more affordable. He'll also fight to protect our environment and to ensure that Iowa remains a great place to live and work. He is the right choice for Iowa at this time. And a reminder that upon retiring from 36 years of being in the Navy, he chose to return home to Iowa. He now lives in Sioux City. And that letter to the editor was written by Colleen Lemke of Spirit Lake, Iowa. And the headline for this next article, switching to the news, Kansas abortion vote shows the limits of GOP's strength. And this article was written by the Associated Press, Topeka, Kansas. An increase in turnout among Democrats and independents and a notable shift in Republican-leaning counties contributed to the overwhelming support of abortion rights in traditionally conservative Kansas, according to an Associated Press analysis of the voting results. A proposed state constitutional amendment that would have allowed the Republican-controlled legislature to tighten restrictions or ban abortion outright, but Kansas voters rejected the measure by nearly 20 percentage points, almost a mirror of Republican Donald Trump's statewide margin over Democrat Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential election. In the aftermath of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to repeal a woman's constitutional right to an abortion, The threat of new restrictions in the state galvanized Democrats and independents more than anticipated. And at the same time, Republicans showed less interest in turning out to support the measure. The findings reinforce a sense in both parties that the Supreme Court's decision may have altered the dynamics of this year's midterm elections. And this next article on the Sioux City Journal newspaper, headline, Crop Hunger Walk to Host Open Houses. The 51st annual Quad Cities Crop Hunger Walk will be held October the 2nd of this year. And to prepare for the event, two open houses will be held for participants to pick up the materials needed to enlist and encourage teams of walkers. In Illinois, the event will take place at First Lutheran Church, 1230 Fifth Avenue in Moline. And in Iowa, the location will be the center located at 14th Street in Davenport, Iowa. And the headline for this next article, SkyWest continues running two daily flights at Sioux City while awaiting official word on charter service request. This article was written by Dave Driesen. SkyWest Airlines continues to operate two flights per day at Sioux City's Gateway Airport, as the Utah-based carrier awaits federal approval of its request to create a new charter service for smaller airports like Sioux City's. SkyWest, which flies connecting routes for United Airlines, offers one daily flight each day to and from Sioux City to Chicago's O'Hare International Airport and Denver's International Airport. In March, SkyWest announced plans to withdraw from Sioux City and 27 other small airports by July, citing a shortage of pilots. And because the flights at those airports are federally subsidized under the Essential Air Service Program, the U.S. Department of Transportation required SkyWest to continue serving those markets until a replacement carrier was selected. SkyWest started at Sioux City Gateway in October of 2020 with its Denver routes, and then added flights to Chicago in April of 2021 under its current EAS contract, which is scheduled to run through April of 2024. In the first year, SkyWest received a subsidy of $2,045 per flight, or nearly $1.7 million. This year, the subsidy dropped to $880,418. In the final year, the subsidy will be scheduled to fall to $533,437. Well, that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper, dated Wednesday, August the 17th. I'm your reader, Kevin Boucher, and you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.